From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The term model minority usually makes people uncomfortable. It's used sometimes to describe Asian Americans in general and Asian American students in particular. The stereotype is that those students always excel in the classroom, dominate test score results, and occupy a disproportionate number of places on the college campus. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk about the term model minority and what's missing in the way that term is usually understood. The myth of the model minority and the reality of the Asian American student experience. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When the University of California, Berkeley enrollment figures were announced for the last school year, they included a familiar statistic. The demographic group with the largest enrollment was Asian American students, representing some 47% of the student population at UC Berkeley. That dominant figure, 47%, is often cited when people talk about the so-called model minority. That characterization was the subject of a report earlier this year out of New York University called Fact Not Fiction, Setting the Record Straight. The report notes that some 48 different ethnic groups are lumped together under the Asian American umbrella and that there is wide variation in how Korean Americans fare in school, say, compared to Laotian Americans. In this hour forum, we want to take up this sometimes uncomfortable term and topic, that of the model minority. What are we missing when we merge Asian Americans into one group? How does that impact expectations and student performance? Who's not getting help based on assumptions of high achievement? And how does Asian American college enrollment impact other minority student groups? Joining us to take up this topic this hour, Robert Taranishi. He's professor of higher education at New York University and the director of the recent report on the myth of the model minority. Professor Taranishi, good morning.
Good morning.
Here too is Dua Thoa. She's executive director of the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center. Dua Thoa, good morning.
Good morning.
And Elaine Kim joins us as well. She's professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Kim, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk about the findings of your report first, Professor Taranishi. One of the points, the central point really of the report, is that we do tend to lump people together under this enormous umbrella called Asian American. And what happens then is that we don't pay enough attention to different people along a very large spectrum. Point out some of those variations, if you would.
You're right. The demographic trends are often overlooked when we consider who Asian Americans are, particularly the diversity that exists within the population. To give you an example, you actually cited one of them, which is that there are 48 different ethnic groups that fall under the larger Asian American and Pacific Islander racial category. And among these groups, there's a lot of variation in terms of immigration histories, English language ability, and differences in socioeconomic status. And what we were trying to do is to point out some of those differences and link those differences to educational opportunities and mobility. Just to give you a couple examples, in Brooklyn, New York, we have a community, Chinese-American community, that's mainly in Sunset Park. And three-quarters of the Chinese in that community are foreign-born. And nearly two-thirds of the children speak English less than very well. That population is very distinct from other Asian populations that you could find in other parts of the country.
And there's also wide variation in the percentage of Asian Americans who have received a college education or, for that matter, a high school degree. We make this assumption when I cite the figure that 47% of the students at a prestigious university like the University of California, Berkeley, are Asian American, that everyone under that grouping is doing well. But your report points out that there's, for example, a very small percentage of Laotian Americans, for example, who have received college degrees.
Yeah, just in terms of educational attainment, yeah, there's a huge variation in terms of those that, you know, have attained higher levels of education. So among the Hmong population in the U.S., 60% of them in 2000 had less than high school education. This is among the adult population. And that's a very different figure than among the, say, the Asian Indian population, where, 64-65% of the population has a BA degree or greater.
Robert Teranishi is professor of higher education at New York University. Dua Thoa, at the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center, you are Hmong American. What's important, then, about understanding those distinctions? What do we miss? What do the schools miss when we sort of lump everyone together under the same umbrella?
I think that what happens is that when most policymakers and institutions or institutions of higher education as well as local schools don't understand those dynamics, I think they create policies and they create programs that are supposed to support underserved communities, and many times they're not targeted to our communities, or when outreach programs are created so that our communities can engage, they're not a part of that population that they outreach to, and often it just creates a perpetual cycle of then those communities continuing to be overlooked, and in our mind, I think ultimately that hurts the overall community, because you do see many students then who don't have the opportunity to rise out and go to college or finish college, and so they're still stuck in the same kind of situations, and their communities continue to be impoverished.
And what should we understand, and what should schools understand in terms of those specific ethnic differences? Are there differences in attitudes towards education that schools should be aware of? Are there differences in what the immigrant experience has been like? If you're a recent immigrant from Vietnam or Cambodia, how that might be different, for example, than someone who is of Taiwanese descent and perhaps been in this country for a much longer period of time?
You know, I often tell people that I have more in common sometimes with a Somali refugee than I do with someone who's third or fourth generation Chinese American, and not in a bad way, but just as the fact that our histories are so different. I came as a refugee too, and it was the first in my family to go to college, and so it's really difficult sometimes to relate to someone who's been here for multiple generations who may be in a different circle. And the idea is that because experiences are so different, that means that they're ability to have employment in the family is different. It means they might have really large families, like the average size in Hmong families is 6 compared to the average American family. Languages are different, culture is different, but also just access to resources are really different. I think there's an assumption that we all speak English, so we know how to maneuver the American system, but linguistic isolation is really high in the Southeast Asian communities. In fact, they have very little access to systems around them.
And at University of California, Berkeley, Professor Elaine Kim, what do you see in terms of how the Asian American student population is faring? Do you see differences between Chinese American students and Laotian American students? How prepared is the university to break apart, I guess, that lump that's sometimes called the model minority?
We really don't have very many Hmong students or students from Laos, and we only recently started having more Cambodian American students, very few in the graduate program and relatively few in the undergraduate program compared with Chinese, for example, which is the largest Asian group, or even compared with Koreans or Vietnamese. So when you ask how they're faring, the few Southeast Asian students who are not Vietnamese who come in are probably faring okay, but they would have been the most highly assimilated and most highly, would have had would be at the highest grade point average from their high schools and so on.
And what is the sense at UC Berkeley these days in terms of the other side of this, which is a resentment about whether or not Asian Americans are taking a disproportionate share of the available places at a prestigious school like Berkeley?
Well, I don't know, because people wouldn't tell me, probably wouldn't say that to me. But about 25 years ago, about 20 years ago, the university administration was beginning to worry about there being too many Asian American students, and they told us that the alumni who were mostly not Asian American or not people of color were complaining that the complexion of the campus wasn't looking very much like what they were familiar with or comfortable with. And so there were some moves made at that time to try to change the admissions requirements so that, for example, there would be less emphasis on math aptitude and more emphasis on English aptitude, or there would be different requirements. For example, students who had 4 years of English in the United States and European language background would have an advantage over students who didn't. And but that that whole effort was contested by people in the Asian, mostly Chinese American community, and other East Asian American communities. And so finally, in the late 1980s, it was the university administration actually apologized for that and stopped doing it. So there was resentment, but it wasn't necessarily on the part of fellow students, actually. And now, you know, if you ask if there's resentment, I can't say. I do notice that if there's a class full of Asian Americans, then sometimes students from other backgrounds might be reluctant to take that class, and they might say things like, well, you know, I won't do very well in this class if it's graded on a curve, something like that, because they generalize about those students being hyper-conscientious.
Elaine Kim, professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Robert Taranishi, how do you respond to that sort of discomfort, I guess, that people sometimes feel? And is it, again, why it's important to perhaps break apart this large group, Asian American, and look at it in different ways, because otherwise you do face the prospect of people being resentful about a large group when in fact it's many groups?
Yeah, I guess I would start by saying that, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the issues you're referring to are kind of tied to the, in a lot of ways, to the affirmative action debate.
Right.
And a lot of the discussion now is how Asians are the biggest winners without affirmative action. And, you know, affirmative action doesn't just hurt white students. It hurts Asians the most. You know, Ward Connerly recently, he said, you know, if we are to increase black enrollment in the UC system, it means kicking out Asian students. And I say that's interesting because it's not Asians who tend to assert these arguments. So it's not Asians who feel that they're necessarily being negatively affected by policies such as affirmative action. And I think what this conversation reflects more is, you know, a system that it can't accommodate the number of students that it should be. You know, that focusing on Asians, it's an excuse not to deal with the failure of our education system and the complex nature of, you know, race and how it affects, you know, access to resources. The state of California in particular, they have tremendous challenges related to capacity, and they're not helping that problem by using very strict terms when it comes to defining what constitutes merit. And, you know, so I think on the one hand, I'm concerned about how Asians are included in some of these discussions, but on the other hand, I think it's important for people to be having a conversation about, you know, what's occurring in terms of the limited access to the finite resources in the state.
Tua Thor at the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center, how do you view that particular tension that sometimes exists, resentment that sometimes exists about the supposed success of Asian Americans writ large on university campuses?
You know, I think we're supportive of Asian Americans doing well. I think that the point of this conversation is not about blaming those students for doing well, but it's really around looking at a system that, as Robert mentioned, isn't really up to date. I mean, the way that our populations look now is so different from the way that these terms were defined many years ago. And you have biracial families now. You have many different ethnic groups. And I do think that the education system is having a hard time trying to figure out how to include and have quality data at the same time be effective and efficient, right? I think the biggest discussion that always comes out is, well, if we break down your data, we have to break down everyone's data. That's too complicated and it costs too much money. And our response has always been, whether you're doing it or not, local school districts are doing it because they need to understand their populations better. And in fact, systematizing it could help everyone create systems for those who don't, and then for those who do can help really use that information across state lines so that people can understand that you're comparing apples to apples. Right?
So what needs to be done, especially in a time where resources are, Robert Taranishi mentioned the enormous problems that are facing the state of California, not only in higher education, but of course in K through 12 as well. Given those complicated and limited circumstances, what needs to be done? What's realistic that could be done to address the sort of diversity, Duathoa, that you're describing? Because we've talked so far about Southeast Asians and East Asia in China. We haven't even gotten to South Asia and Pakistani Indians and so forth. Given that enormous diversity, what is it? Is it realistic, I guess, for schools to really be able to focus in on each and every part of that collective?
Yeah, I think our framing is not to pull out every ethnic data and that's going to give you the quality information that you need. I do think that we think the different school systems need to look at what types of data they need to pull out, as well as how do they interpret that data, right? And so something that we've advocated for and we've had conversations with the Secretary of Education on is looking at some pilot projects across the country of local school districts who are collecting good data already, trying to see what they do, looking at populations across the country that have a diverse group of students and see if there's an opportunity in that school district to collect data and interpret data differently. There is this thinking that a lot of Asian Americans are only in San Francisco or New York, but our population is actually really spread out. There are large populations in Atlanta and the Midwest and the South now, and we do think that more than anything, those states are going to need systems to be able to understand our populations better.
And when you say collect better data or have better systems, do you mean specifically that we need to collect more detailed demographic data so that there isn't just a box that you check that says Asian American, that it's much more specific, that there is a Hmong American or a Vietnamese American or a Indian American?
I think it has to do with ethnic data as well as looking at language, right? Much of that is already collected in the school districts, what students and their language capacity is, how over the long term they're doing, so that you're not just collecting a test score at a certain time and space, but you're looking at the long-term effects of where a student is going and how they are doing in the school system.
Do we need to divide up people more? I shouldn't say divide. That's not the right way to put it, Elaine Kim, but I guess I'm interested in whether or not we need to hyphenate who we are more. Do you know what I mean? So that we're saying more specifically Laotian hyphen American and so forth. Is there a need to break people apart so that we really do have a better standing of what each group is and what individual needs are?
I think that it's kind of a laughable argument to say that collecting a diversity of data is too expensive and therefore not something that our leaders could support, because we need to, I think, in the abstract, we need to change our priorities so that we focus on people's needs, because it's kind of unfair to ask all of us to try to come up with a solution for the education crisis, schooling crisis in the United States one by one, because actually it's a question of putting priority on people's needs. It wouldn't be, it's not that expensive to collect a diversity of data if you compare it with, something else like bombs for Iraq or whatever. But I do think that a good example of collecting a diversity of data without disaggregating the Asian American population so they don't have any racial identity was done at UC Berkeley's undergraduate admissions office, where the admissions office tried very hard to know each public school in the state of California. So they would collect data to show how many kids in a particular school were qualified for subsidized lunch, for example, or what's the proportion of students from that school that goes to college, and what's the history of students from that school going to UC Berkeley. And so it wasn't, since we were not allowed to look at race, we did look at a whole host of factors that were economic, socioeconomic, and that could yield a diversity and fairness in our student admissions. And we did take into account if a student came from a school where everybody goes to college and they all have really high SAT scores, that student might have less opportunity to be looked at than a student who came from a school where hardly anybody had ever gone to UC Berkeley, and that student did very well, but they didn't have a lot of advanced classes in that school, for example. So I think we need more data. I want us to disaggregate the students from Laos and Cambodia from the students from China, but at the same time, students from China are very diverse, as has already been suggested. So breaking apart the congealed sort of identities and looking at many different data is really a smart idea.
Elaine Kim, Professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. If you go to a break in just a moment, Robert Ternishi, but your view on this, on disaggregating, as Elaine Kim put it, or adding more hyphens to the data that we collect, there's sometimes a feeling that the historian Arthur Schlesinger, for example, has made the argument in the past that a difficulty in America is that, as he put it, there's too much pluribus and not enough unum, that we focus too much on all our differences. But it sounds like all of what each of you are saying is that it's really important to understand all those differences.
Yeah, I mean, it's a social reality of American society, you know, so to ignore it doesn't make it go away. And we've recognized that problem when it comes to race and as well as class. And, you know, so for the Asian population to ascribe them to, you know, racial category, it does serve some purposes. But, you know, it's also important to recognize the distinctions within the population, which tend to be much greater you know, among Asian Americans than is true for other racial populations. And we have a lot of data to kind of support that. In many ways, you know, Asians are, you know, have more differences and similarities. And it's just thinking about the ways in which that affects individuals within the population.
Robert Ternishi, professor of higher education at New York University, who helped put together the latest report on challenging the myth of the model minority. When we come back, we'll talk about that topic more. We welcome your phone calls, particularly if you are an Asian American student or parent and you'd like to weigh in on this idea of the model minority and the problems with it and how we might better look at the needs of all students. We welcome your phone calls now. Here's the phone number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Back with more on the topic of the model minority, myth or fact, when we come back. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the myth of the model minority. Our guests include Robert Ternishi, professor of higher education at New York University and co-director of the National Commission on Asian American and Pacific Islander Research in Education, Dua Thoa, who is the executive director of the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center. She joins us from Washington, and Elaine Kim, professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. We welcome your calls and participation in our conversation, too. If you're an Asian American student, what has been your experience? What would you like people to know that maybe they do not? You can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. Let's go right to Judy, who joins us first this morning from San Francisco. Judy, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I think that the business about people, you know, doing well, I mean, it's obvious that the Asians, their families are, you know, more together, they help each other, and they're going to do better. And then, you know, then it just goes down in terms of who puts in time with their kids. It's not a big question. When I was going to school, it was the same way, you know, and that was a long, long time ago. And, you know, this all needs to be started in grade school. You know, we don't get enough money for you don't need to tear things apart because we should know these things about Laos and Cambodia and, you know. Did I say what I needed to say there?
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Thanks for the call and the observation. Interesting, Duotho, that she went right to the point of families, that Asian American kids are supported by more their families, encouraged to do well in school. Again, it's a big generalization that Judy is making across all of the different 48 groups that Robert Taranishi was describing. But what's your response to that sense or assumption? Is that yet another stereotype that Asian American families are much more supportive of their children's academic aspirations?
You know, I can't speak for all Asian Americans, clearly, because my experience is within a certain population of that, and particularly around the refugee population. I do want to say from what I've seen that a lot of the refugee parents that have come to this country, because they had such persecution in their own country and many of them never went to school, really stress that and tried to support their children to go into education. I also want to say that many of them didn't have the skill sets to give them the opportunities they needed. So even though they gave them a lot of support, in some areas you did have involvement of Southeast Asians in gang-related activity and in crime. And I think that that's the reality of the situation, both in poor communities as well as communities who have more privilege of students who you could have support from a family but not necessarily all the tools. And I just want to say that I think that while there's a general sense in our communities of support from parents, there are many troubled areas, too, that doesn't represent whether that entire community is bad or not, but I think it sits in a certain social political time, right, and then makes a difference about their histories and where they come from.
Robert Taranishi, what's your view on that assumption that families are more supportive? It's certainly the generalizable stereotype that, you know, students are encouraged, perhaps particularly encouraged to do well in school, particularly in math and the sciences. I know you've done some work in breaking that apart, particularly when it comes to what kids actually do wind up majoring in. But what's your view of that sort of general stereotypical view of Asian American families?
Well, I think that perception is very deeply ingrained in people's ideas about Asian Americans. And, you know, I've looked at the research in this area, and I've conducted some of my own research on some of these issues. And, you know, the evidence, in my opinion, it's not quite there. What I see more so is, you know, the Asian experience is very much an immigrant experience. And, you know, the trend in terms of immigrants and immigrant families pushing their kids to succeed in education, that's common across almost all immigrant groups. And the difference is whether or not, groups will have access to resources that will enable them to actually realize some of their goals. And what we're finding is that among some Asian groups, they are able to access the right resources and, have that mobility. But there's a lot of groups that don't have access to those resources. In fact, a study I did recently, I looked at different Asian ethnic groups and the role of the parents and their families and schools and the ways in which they're able to facilitate mobility, educational mobility for their kids. And the most common trend was that, parents, they did push their kids to pursue college and do well in school. But the pressure was definitely there, but their ability to actually help them facilitate that process was not always there. And what happens more often than not is that students need to rely on whatever resources are available in the schools. And, you know, not all schools are equal in terms of their ability to, you know, prepare and provide resources when it comes to post-secondary educational options.
Which takes us back to the point each of you have made about the importance of having good information so that schools can provide that sort of access and that sort of assistance to the particular needs of a particular individual, family, or group.
Absolutely.
Jimmy is next in Castro Valley this morning. Jimmy, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got a question. I'm a Filipino-American. What if someday when my son, I got a son in middle school right now, what if a time for him to go to college, will he get a better chance of being admitted to school like Berkeley if we claim he's Hispanic descent? Because we do have Hispanic last name.
Jimmy, thanks. It's a practical, pragmatic question on college admissions. Elaine Kim.
Sorry, I didn't hear his question.
His question was, as a Filipino-American, but also someone who has Latino descent, what will help his son best get into college?
I don't think he should lie about his heritage. That would not be good. That would not help his son in the long run. And I don't think it, you know, we're at Berkeley anywhere, we're not supposed to do admissions based on race and ethnicity or gender. So it wouldn't make any difference. He should just help his student, help his son do well and fill out his application forms well.
Is there a sense, Robert Taranishi, that there is there a concern, I guess, among some Asian American families that there is a kind of reverse prejudice in effect here? You quote in your report the old joke about MIT really stands I'm forgetting now the exact phrase, but it's that they are, you know, that it really has to do with made in Taiwan.
Right.
So is there a concern about that? So that the thought that you should be disingenuous about your ethnicity because of that concern?
Yeah, I mean, the caller's question really speaks to how people are really, how they perceive the college admissions process, particularly when it comes to selective college admissions. So, you know, they're seeing it as a game where they have to compete. And, you know, and the challenge is figuring out, well, what is it that the institutions want? You know, what is it that they value? And I think that's a good question to ask, and one that universities should articulate better, you know, because they should say, you know, this is what we don't take into account, but then this is also what we do value. And they have to say more about what they do and how they do it, and that would help people, you know, think about the types of things that they should be doing. When it comes to Asians and how they approach the selective college admissions process, there is a sentiment out there that they have to compete against other Asians to be admitted. And there's evidence that that is affecting where do they apply to school, how many schools they apply to, you know, in their college decision-making process generally.
Dania in Williams, Arizona, joins us next. Dania, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a student at a university in northern Arizona working on my master's, actually, in secondary education. And we talk a lot about having different ethnic groups in our classroom and not just trying to make them reach our standards, which are, you know, laid down by traditionally the dominant culture, and more about trying to allow those students to really work towards the values that their culture and that their families really hold to. And I just kind of think that if we really start wanting to be progressive in our education and allowing all individuals to be liberated, then we really have to start focusing more on what those individuals want to be achieving and not having to make them work harder to get into our universities. And then once we do allow them to get into our universities or even just to be able to be competitive within their own secondary education, how are we really trying to support them as individual cultures and not necessarily as clumping them into our idea of what they should be to succeed in our country. And our emphasis is really not on that anymore, and I just think it's really sad.
Danya, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation. Tuatha, your reaction. Danya's making an argument in part for having a different set of standards and to encourage people based on what their heritage and ethnicity is, perhaps, rather than saying everyone has to climb across a particular bar.
You know, I think there's been a lot of debate in the last couple of years with No Child Left Behind around just general standards and also new concepts that will really help school systems better understand students. And something that we're supportive of is bringing in culturally relevant curriculum. In particular, we're in partnership with the Coalition for High School Equity, where there are a number of partners, including those that represent Native American communities, who've talked for a long time about teaching their curriculum and bringing in those community experiences so that their students can better relate to the education system and can better succeed. And I feel like there is an important place to definitely have some standards that people think are comparable across schools, but there is really a space to, there is a need to definitely understand where students are coming from. And in particular, even the caller who called in earlier also, I think his point also brought up the importance of really understanding students better, because many people don't even know that Filipino students have Latino last names, right? And so all of these all of these play into the idea of understanding students and their context better.
Some of our email coming in. Sydney writes, as a Chinese American who grew up in Hong Kong and arrived in the United States when I was 16, I was brought up in a merit-based education and employment system where race was never an issue. So being lumped into a group because of my race was a shock to me in the beginning. Also, the term model minority or Asian American baffled me because the term lumped a large group of people with different cultural values, socioeconomic status, as well as familial support. I'm sure people would not lump Germans and French necessarily together. And Naveen writes, the topic of discussion is good, but I feel you've forgotten a large group of people. That's Asians from the Indian subcontinent. Are Asians from the subcontinent considered to be part of that 47% of Asian American students at UC Berkeley? I hope you address those issues. Do you know, Elaine Kim, when we talk about that 47% figure, does that include Asians from both South Asia as well as East and Southeast Asia?
Don't believe it does.
All right. Well, we know that much, at least, that it does not include that. So in some ways, Robert Taranishi, that gets at these very questions, because we sort of make certain assumptions and then we learn that maybe the box doesn't include every category.
Well, it's interesting. It speaks to the, you know, what are the boundaries of the, you know, this racial population. After we released our report, we had a lot of press coverage, and so it resulted in a lot of different email inquiries to our project. And, you know, it's fascinating. People were emailing saying, you know, why didn't you include Russia in your study? Hmm. You know, I'm Russian, and you don't talk about us in your study. And, you know, we had people from the Middle East asking similar questions. And we also did interviews with international press. And so we had some papers from the Middle East who are calling us, and it kind of speaks to the challenge of defining, you know, who Asian Americans are. And when we have data about Asians, who that represents. And I just want to share with you an example. There was a report that was put out by the American Council on Education, and it showed that 32% of doctorates conferred in the U.S. in 2000 were to Asians, and I put Asians in quotes. It turns out that actually 86% of those degrees were actually conferred to international students, but, you know, people wouldn't really think to question that data. You know, they're saying, well, Asians get these degrees, and this number is representing Asians. But, you know, this is why we need to be able to look at the data from different perspectives to know if we're, you know, accurately representing the information the way we want to.
It's really peeling back the layers. And once you peel one layer, there's another, and then there's another. The Filipino-American who called in earlier called back to say that he wouldn't be misrepresenting if he had his son check the box that said Hispanic because, as Duethoa was pointing out, a large majority of Filipinos have both Asian and Hispanic heritage. So it is indeed a multi-layered question. Let's go next to John, who joins us from Vacaville this morning. John, go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks
Good morning.
For taking my call. The question that I have is I currently work as a firefighter for Bay Area Fire Department, and I've also went to four-year college. And the thing that Asian Americans find, or I find, is that we not only have to compete with other minorities for these positions, but we also have to struggle against these minority or model minority stereotypes that somehow the Asians can't be cops or firemen.
Hmm.
And maybe your expert board could address that issue.
John, thank you. Duethoa, do you want to respond to that sense that John, as a Korean-American, faces certain stereotypes that Asian-Americans aren't necessarily who you imagine when you think of cops or firefighters?
There's definitely a framework used for Asian-Americans where we become kind of the wedge race whenever it fits someone else's space, right? And there are so many different types of stereotypes about Asian-Americans that it does make it difficult. I mean, there was a recent study by the EOC, the Equal Opportunity Employment Agency, at the federal department, talking about how Asian-Americans were not in senior levels at all in federal government agencies here in Washington, D.C. And so there is a definite recognition that there's a hindrance or stereotypes that are barriers for Asian-Americans. And the idea that they're all in higher education doesn't mean that they're represented in the same way across corporations and executive VP positions and those types of things. And so that's also the complexity of our situation.
Does that also, Elaine Kim, get into certain stereotypes about Asian-Americans as being, you know, polite and always well-behaved and all the rest, and that might be some of what John is facing, that there isn't a sense necessarily that they're going to have some of the attributes you want in a policeman?
Well, I think that it's ironic that Chinese labor and Japanese labor is pretty responsible for the development of agriculture and land reclamation on the Pacific Coast, which, you know, contributed most importantly to the development of California as the richest state in the United States
right. At
the time, and that they would be considered physically not good enough to be firefighters or policemen, which was a big problem and had to be fought tooth and nail by civic groups like Chinese for Affirmative Action. So I think he's quite right, and I think that There was at Berkeley anyway the idea that Asians are mimetic but not creative, so that they could sort of copy other people's ideas in engineering and so on, and but not originate ideas, and that would mean that we would not be good leaders, for example. And it is interesting that although 47% of the undergraduate student body is East Asian or Southeast Asian, that you can't see this reflected in decision making in the administration anywhere, and then there's the other problem.
You mean by who has leadership positions within the UC Berkeley?
Who's the dean? Who's a chair? Chancellor? Who has ever been in those positions except for Chang Lin-tien back before he died? And the other problem that kids complain about sometimes is the hypersexualization of Asian women as exotic sex objects and geisha girls, while the men are considered socially inept and nerdy and asexual. So there are things that go along with that model minority stuff that are very offensive and detrimental. Plus, I think the main thing that we tend to forget is what both Robert and Dua suggested, that model minority implies the comparison with other minorities, so that as Dua mentioned, it's a wedge situation, or a situation in which there's an implied hierarchy that Asians are supposed to be, quote, more polite than blacks or better students than Latinos, but although less original and creative and sexually attractive or sexually normal than Anglos. So the whole origin of the model minority idea was a kind of a comment about you know, majority race versus different hierarchy of minority groups.
Duathoa, I know you have to run before the end of our hour, so I just want to give you an opportunity for a last comment on that particular challenge.
You know, I think more than anything, I feel really hopeful about the opportunities that exist. I do think that disaggregating data and getting that information is still an uphill battle for us, but the young students and I think the individual students that are in society now are very artistic, aggressive, and very active around these issues more than ever, and we feel really excited for that, and we are hopeful about what that would mean for future policy changes.
Duathoa, who is the Executive Director of Southeast Asia Resource Action Center in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being part of our program.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Let's get in another call or two if we can before the end of our hour. Luis joins us next from San Francisco. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just a bit concerned as a Filipino-American. The way they categorize us as Pacific Islanders, when actually I had the opportunity to study in the Philippines and it's more linked to Asian culture than Pacific Islander.
Yeah, thanks for the call and observation. Yet another layer, Robert Taranishi, because you're in fact the co-director of the National Commission on Asian American and Pacific Islander Research and Education. So how do you do your differentiations, I guess, there?
Yeah, actually, the Filipino population, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, they don't categorize them as a Pacific Islander population. They're actually treated as an Asian American population. And so I guess to speak more specifically to these categorizations, they split Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders into, you know, these two categories. And there's, while there's 48 categories total, it's 24 within each. So even among Pacific Islanders, there's a tremendous amount of diversity that is not recognized in terms of ethnicity and country of origin.
Because it makes an assumption that a native of Hawaii and a native of Tonga are the same, when in fact their cultural differences, of course, are quite a lot.
Exactly, yeah. And some are, you know, of course, U.S. citizens, and you know, some are not, and there's very complex relationships that the United States has with the Pacific Island region, which you know, creates a very diverse and you know, fascinating Pacific Island population that's really not recognized in a lot of ways in the U.S.
Let's get in one more caller. Murali joins us from San Jose. Murali, go ahead, please.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having me on this call. I really enjoyed your program. I won't belabor the fact that there are many, many layers to this onion. I just wanted to shed some light on the Indian American community. Again, I don't intend to represent the whole community. My intersect is primarily the Silicon Valley folks. And I believe the Indian American or students of Indian American origin have a phenomenal advantage. You know, I look at my own sons. Right from childhood, they can see their parents view education as a number one priority, almost to the exclusion of everything else. Second is that you know, being trained in English as a language I think in, my ability to help and with them in their studies and stuff is pretty good. And the third area is that we come from probably the least differential of the Asian communities. And so to break molds, to be iconoclastic, is much more easy in this community. So the kids of Indian American origin start out at some major advantages. The disadvantages, we believe that success can be gained through very narrow channels, you know, engineering, doctors, or lawyers and stuff. And that puts a crimp on kids expressing themselves and excelling in their fields of excellence. And that's an area that Indian Americans need to watch out for.
Thank you. Thanks for the call and the observation. And it takes us back, I guess, to our point of origin, Elaine Kim. So a last thought on that, on the importance of understanding that, as Murali was describing, his experience and the experience of his children is very different than it might be for someone who was from an immigrant from Laos or somewhere else.
Well, I want to underscore what Dua said before she had to go, that I think that what's happening is that the students that I see, the undergraduate students that I see, are insisting on their diversity, and so the institutions are going to have to recognize it. And for example, back in the day when I was a graduate student, we all had to study Beowulf and Jane Austen, which is fine. But now we not only have to study Beowulf and Jane Austen, but because of the students, because of what students want to study, we also have to study more diverse literature. So, these things do change as people demand the changes, and I am hopeful that it will happen.
Elaine Kim, Professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Kim, thanks for being part of our program today.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank Robert Teranishi, Professor of Higher Education at New York University and co-director of the National Commission on Asian American and Pacific Islander Research in Education. Professor Teranishi, thanks for being with us, too.
Thank you.
And Dua Thoet joined us earlier. She is the executive director of the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center. She joined us from Washington, D.C. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer, our engineer for this past hour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. We also want to pay thanks to our summer interns who wrap up their work this week, Joey Kahn, Shazia Jaffrey, Kelly Pretzer, Megan Rollins, and Allison Van Diglin. Thanks all to all of you for all of your help to Forum this past summer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.